Welcome to Label Sessions Presents, the podcast where we talk to the most interesting people about all the things you need to know in the worlds of innovation, business, design, tech, and culture. I'm Fazlin Iso down in sunny South Africa. And today we're joined by two brand new label mates joining the Label Sessions roster, as well as Label Sessions director Nick Sherrod. Nick, what are we looking at this week?
So today we want to talk about Dub, which is a new fintech app which has just launched and has very big backing, so $70 million seed and 800,000 downloads already. And they claim to be getting younger people investing. So you want to talk around what should the rest of the world of fintech and finance in particular learn from Dub. Also, I want to talk about Lululemon next, so a brand that we work with at Label Sessions, but they've announced massive big growth plans for the future. So how do we think they can achieve some of that? And also, what can the rest of the world of business and brands learn from the success of Lululemon? And then thirdly and finally, which is actually a story we were first alerted to by Michelle on this call, actually. But in terms of just this week, we've got a new brand platform being launched by OpenAI with Sonic branding at its heart, which is a topic that's also quite close to Label Sessions' heart. So how can companies in the sea of new brands that there are in AI stand out?
Amazing. We're also joined by Josh Nixon, who makes all of this great content happen. Josh, what can we expect from Label Sessions this week?
So it's another big week for us. So we have our continued sort of partnership with FinTech Scotland, which we go along and help organise and help put together their Financial Regulation Innovation Lab. They've just kicked off the innovation to address financial crime. And I was there just on Tuesday getting some lovely little videos for them and also helping facilitate that. And then we have two Lomi accelerators coming up. We've just launched the one with Vincent Corver, the Sonic Branding Accelerator, last week, which is coming along really well. And then we have two more based on one on cyber innovation and one on consumer duty. So lots to go through and lots to come up.
Exciting. Now, as I mentioned, we are joined by two brand new label mates who are coming to us from the Asia region today. First up, Elisa Michelet, a Tokyo-based branding and design expert known for her ability to craft holistic brands and bridge the gap between culture and design. Now, Elisa, you've worked with Patagonia, Facebook, Amazon, Airbnb. What do leaders in the world of design need to know right now?
Let's see. I feel like branding is definitely having a moment right now, or has been for the past few years, which is great. I think people are understanding that, you know, it's not just a logo anymore. Brands are way more three-dimensional. So I think that's really exciting and there's a lot to play with, but it also is feeling very saturated and things are looking kind of similar. And so I think I'm just excited kind of where things will go, how things will evolve, how things will stay fresh. And I think that's going to be, you know, really big for what's next. I mean, I think, you know, in some way that's always been an issue with branding, right? Like how to set yourself apart. But I think it's as important as ever because so many people are investing in it and it's just getting harder to differentiate yourself.
Percent. Welcome, Alicia. And also a big welcome to Michelle Koh, a master connector in the creative and marketing ecosystem within Asia. Based out of Singapore, Michelle specializes in weaving together local talent and international opportunities and has also been instrumental in brand strategies that resonate authentically within the region. What are some of the key things business leaders need to know about entering the Asian markets right now, Michelle?
I mean, I think right now leaders, especially in the marketing and creative industries, need to have a much clearer view about sustainability, not just in the environmental sense, but in terms of business models, talent retention, and creative output. The original churn and burn approach to clients, this race at the bottom on pricing and the obsession with short-term wins, none of that is really built to last. So leaders looking to enter this market really need to think about future-proofing. How do they design creative businesses that don't just survive the next disruption, but thrive in it? And really look at building marketing ecosystems that are not just dependent on one big campaign or one platform, And how do you position yourself as a long-term strategic partner within, community, within your audience, within your clients? And these are the conversations that I'm having with my clients and the ones that I think more leaders should be prioritizing when they're entering Southeast Asia and Asia at large.
Amazing. Thanks so much, Michelle.
Mm-hmm.
So lots happening this week. One of the big things is the release of a new fintech app. It's launched with big backing, big buzz, and it's getting younger people investing. What should the rest of the world of finance be learning from Dub, this new app? Let's kick off with Nick.
Oh, really? I never get in.
I know. Trust. I thought I'd give you a chance to kick us off.
I think it's interesting. It's actually in the notes when we were preparing the show. I think I was writing it, and I wrote Bud rather than Dub. And Bud was another really highly backed fintech app a few years ago. They kind of did okay, but didn't quite come through on its full thing. So I think there's an interesting thing in the kind of concept of Dub seems to be very much focused on copying. So the idea is that you kind of see people who are investing, and you can straightforwardly copy them. And I guess one of the things that's quite cheeky about the proposition is some of those people are not technically on the platform. So there's quite a few. Nancy Pelosi seems to be the one they're kind of driving people towards, which is an interesting kind of trend in the world, and maybe especially in North America just now around, people are talking in the sort of trends community around the kind of mask off era. So it's kind of the thing they're kind of saying quite explicitly is these people know something you don't. So if you follow them, you might get an inside track. So there's things that are interesting there in the sense of that's an interesting core idea. And also in terms of, I don't know what everyone else thinks, I think the kind of identity and the branding they seem to have gone with around this is quite, might say, aspirational. It's almost a little bit like harking back to kind of yuppie era, sort of like almost a sort of past era. So I think it's interesting where there's clearly something here which is getting traction. So there's clearly something we should pay attention to in that. I'm not sure how attractive this is. I'm not sure how much I like it. I'm not sure how much people think this is a good thing in the world, but there's something here which seems to be getting some traction. So we need to understand, I suspect, but I'm not sure it's positive.
Yeah, I think it's really interesting. It clearly shows that we're not at the end of the influencer era. Like clearly there's this idea that, people are interested in what other people are doing and at all levels, even what they're doing with their finances. So I totally agree. I think it's super interesting. I tried to download it today and sign up, and it was, obviously they need to do some legal verifications and all that. But it seems like they're leaning into this idea of education, which I think is cool. So I think that's going to be maybe one of their differentiators is helping. It's not just, get on and invest, but also invest safely. And so I'm not exactly sure to what extent that's true, but I think as younger generations join, that's very important because, they don't have the same tools that, people who are familiar with the stock market do. So, and they're making big financial decisions. So I think it's great if they continue that route of kind of educating new users about investing.
I think what's fascinating is they clearly have a really strong awareness of their audience and their audience behavior, because there's a huge barrier to smart investing amongst young people, right? We don't have time to invest in getting these financial knowledge or like understanding of financial instruments. So creating a platform that mimics financially successful people in their place just completely reduces that friction to investment. And it creates such an incredibly gratifying and rewarding system. They could even gamify it. So I think they really know at the end of the day who their end users are. Fusen, you said something really interesting about how the influencer economy is still kind of present and still here to stay. I think with how Dud has done it, it does mark a shift away from traditional influencers like selling products, selling things, selling clothes and gadgets and fancy shoes, to moving towards creators with gravity, like the ability to influence your life in the long term, like financial planning or even health. So we do, I mean, from what I see, I do see that creative position sort of moved away from something that's more surface level and the one that gets embedded into more parts of an individual's life as they grow up and become, adults.
It's kind of interesting that as well, because it's kind of there's a sort of tension in this as a proposition to some degree, which is on one hand it's saying, hey, we're going to make it easy for you as an individual to trade and be super smart, but then they're also saying the way you do that is just by copying somebody else. And it's almost, I wonder if at some point there's a space here for someone to say, actually, let's take, whether it's an influencer or take a story around that and actually build a proposition that's much more around, hey, these people really know what they're doing. Just give them their money and don't think about it. You know, especially like the back much more passive type of investment style. Because this is, it'll be interesting, I guess, over time for Dub in terms of once people get up and running on this and they're starting to invest and presumably they'll follow some people or copy some people and that will go well, some people less so. Do they stay on this app investing over time? Or do they get to a point where they go, actually, I'm going to go and do this properly, so to speak, and head over to one of the more established players? That'll be the tension, I think.
Be fantastic. An influencer-led hedge fund. I feel like that could be very interesting. In both ways, right? Like I'm both terrified and also that could be interesting.
Well, exactly. And I do also think there's also like an issue here for regulators around the world if they think models like this go forward, because all the regulation in most, certainly in the US and in Europe, is focused on this idea of every time you access a product, or you're going through what Elisa was going through this morning, she's downloading the thing. Every time you kind of go through accessing a product, the regulator says, you've got to verify it's you, you've got to verify you know what you're doing, all this kind of stuff. But once you're into this kind of relationship where essentially what you're doing is you're handing over your details and then you're going, whatever Nancy Pelosi does, I'm going to do. That is both. Which is quite a different way of people thinking about it, and it's quite challenging for all sides.
So sort of the we've kind of I think we've leapt into the era of like extreme transparency, and hopefully it leads to an era of extreme authenticity and honesty. So if everyone's looking at Nancy Pelosi's trading history, we would hope that that would then be something that becomes a lot more. I'm not going to get political. Let's move on to the next one.
But it's interesting of transparency, because the reason that they can do that with Nancy Pelosi's data is because she's currently a politician. She has to disclose who she's invested in. So it is
Exactly.
interesting, these kind of things of the data trail around all of this. So, it's like it's interesting that in terms of she hasn't opted into this, but someone is really almost making her an influencer, I guess, to Michelle's language. Kind of like she's almost someone else's capitalizing on that as such, because the data has to be there. So that's also like a weird dynamic here, I think.
I mean, you really stop and think about where are the bad actors in this and how could they potentially show up? Because it's like you said, right? It's not Nancy Pelosi making that, creating that profile and like creating all that activity. It's someone looking at what she's doing. So who's stopping a bad actor from being like, oh, this is how I want to shift the market, and these are the plays I'm going to make, and there is a domino effect that follows.
It's also interesting, I guess, to your point as well, around what influencers are now as well, which is the more traditional idea of influence is someone that comes up on your social media feeds that you start to really engage with and really like, and therefore you try and copy what they're doing. What Dub are doing with most of the people they're pushing is pretty much saying, if you don't like these people, if you think that these politicians are on the take, then follow what they're doing, because you might make some money out of it. If you don't like these kind of hardcore traders, then they might be doing some things you're not willing to do, so follow them. It's that that's an actual there's a real kind of sort of shift in the era around what we're, what that kind of influencer or that kind of celebrity.
Now, Lululemon is a brand that we work with often, and they've just announced some big growth goals for the future. And as a category leader, they're well-known, well-recognized brand. How do we think they can achieve this massive growth? And also, what can the rest of the world of business and brands learn from this success that they're sort of backing themselves?
So it was so fascinating, like reading the questions like last night, because I've actually, and then like looking at the Lululemon like article, Because a double business growth is not something that you hear of. You haven't heard of it in a while now, much less 2025, right? In this economy. So yeah, it was great. And I've been actually researching this thesis that the next big consumer brands won't look like brands at all. And Lululemon, I've been looking into them, is actually a great case study on that. Because we were looking at a new consumer brand playbook in that the most successful brands of the future, they're no longer selling products. They're going to be building communities, media channels, ecosystems, and platforms. What Lululemon has enjoyed is that initial competitive advantage was that they were owning this athleisure category even before it was a trend, right? They didn't sell yoga pants. They sold a whole aspirational identity around wellness, mindfulness, performance. And back then, Nike and Adidas, they were really focused on performance athletes. Lululemon were one of the first, or I would even say they were the first to tap into this growing cultural shift whereby there are people living really intentionally now, whether it's through yoga, fitness, or personal growth. So it's this position that places them at an advantage to say, okay, I'm gonna be doubling that that business growth because I've gotten to enjoy such a position within this category. So I do see that they can evolve within this category and change it from the inside out. And I think one of the ways that they could do it is really just go all in on a lifestyle ecosystem. Because I would say that they have brand equity just beyond clothing, just beyond, merch or retail, and they should capitalize on that. I'm sure that they have the critical mass to produce category-defying innovations, right? Like looking at wellness products or like fitness tech integration, even going into performance lifestyle wear. So innovation within the product realm is not far from reach, right? And that could turn into sales channels and a whole sales business line. But beyond that, they have such a cult status amongst their fans and even people who are not purchasers of their brand. They're already seen as that aspirational brand that someone wants to own a piece of Lululemon clothing, especially if you're working out, even more so when you're not working out. So I do see growth in terms of product development, but also community and all around that brand affinity and that brand equity.
Yeah, I'm like not so familiar with Lululemon. I mean, at least not as a customer, but I feel like what I do know about them is exactly what you're saying, Michelle. Like there's so much more than just an apparel company. And I remember, I don't know if they're still doing this, but they used to offer free classes in
Yes.
their stores, which is genius. And you're bringing in customers, potential customers to your store, engaging the local community. So I think that's super smart. And other companies do this as well. Like REI, they're an outdoor company in the US, and they offer workshops and classes in store. And it's so great. Like you can learn how to, how to go camping in the winter. I mean, you're really, practicing what you're preaching or what you're selling, and I think that makes a lot of sense to engage with your fans, your community on that level. They're not just customers, they're also people that you can kind of talk to and interact with.
It's interesting that kind of relationship because I think quite often, especially in the branding world, people talk about being a cult brand and they're therefore going to take it into a kind of approach of sort of like push marketing as to how they're going to cultivate their cult status. Whereas what Lululemon have done is that community building, and that eventually compounds. It's like it's a lot of hard yards to start building it. But also fascinating that it's been able to be so global because actually, when you look them as well. I mean, they can drive a lot of growth just by going to more territories because they haven't spread across the world yet. But it's interesting that kind of core community building mechanism seems to work as well in Canada as it does in Australia, as it does in Germany, as it does elsewhere in the world. It's a kind of you might think that's quite a hard thing to scale, but it's something about the way they've done it that means that it's repetitive. It means that it's able to build genuinely globally. I think also that whole well-being space is just really interesting. Like you said before, Michelle, in terms of like category defining, it is does feel like it's helpfully for them, people's ideas, well-being is has changed quite a lot. So it's kind of gone from a kind of fitness thing with mindfulness at the side to now you can start to see whole things opening up. I think sleep is a really interesting thing just now. People are tracking so much sleep and are so focused on sleeping better and things. You can see how there's a lot of worlds you could start to extend into as a brand like Lululemon, but almost any brand that's interested in well-being just now, I feel like that's opening up quite a lot as to what people are prepared to focus on, spend money on around well-being.
I think Lululemon also feature quite a lot when people are thinking about the future of retail and the future of retail strategy, because a lot of consumer brands have been turning their investments and their focus into e-commerce, right? Whether it's the death of the brick and mortar store, or that, you know, it's just easier for logistics and distribution. But Lululemon seems to have a pretty consistent like retail strategy across its locations. I read an article that their flagship stores act as brand hubs. So yes, you go there and you shop, but the people that you interact with are known as educators that are just meant to train and, you know, anyone, whether you're new to the brand or you've been shopping with Lulu for 5 to 10 years, they're just meant to engage you with that, you know, even more product knowledge, but also leave with that feeling that, oh, this is the community and this is the brand that I represent. Like, there is a reason why I've got 10 leggings in my closet and why I'm here today to get more, or why I'm here to get a gift for a friend. So there, yeah, it's fascinating. Like, when you look at a Lululemon storefront, you know for a fact that someone's going to help you. People are friendly, like, you leave educated, and there's never really that, oh, they're selling me something. It's that, oh, I'm here to learn about this new tech wear that they've just launched, or, you know, a new range that they've just released.
I think also that it's really interesting, that physical space element as well, because I think you know, we've talked in this podcast before, but there's loads of data now around people all around the world essentially being more lonely or being in less contact, and therefore kind of the rise of people being really up for opportunities where you go to a physical space and you do something together with people. And I almost feel like brands are kind of stumbling on that by accident. So even like last week, you're already going up about the number of kids' parties in America that are happening in branches or stores from Sephora. So, which is a nice thing. It was one thing. On the other side, we then saw Lidl, so the value supermarket in Ireland, that was applying for a license to open a pub inside the supermarket, because they were already selling the beer there, and people were sort of going, why can't we sort of hang out here as well? There's genuinely like a power in the physical space, creating an experience around that, that I think is quite important.
Michelle, you're also sort of very instrumental in bringing brands into the Asian markets. Have you seen any big no-nos happen over the last few years?
I think they're just general, I want to say they're general stereotypical assumptions of the region. So one big misconception that people have before they come into Asia is that Asia is just one big market, right? And then we're all just one, everything that you see on the top can be also applied to the bottom. But Asia is made up of many different sub-communities. Like, Southeast Asia itself comprises of so many different countries, so many different languages. And there is this rush to capture this new global consumer class, because Asia now is 55% of the global consumer class. And I would say in this rush to get in, there is that tendency to just overgeneralize, like, okay, the top spenders are in China or in India, for example, but not really looking at specific regions and specific communities. So what I tend to advise clients is to really look at which audience categories you want to serve, and who are the spenders, who are your competitors, and who are existing brands already that are within there. And more importantly, who are your people going to be, right? It's your potential community, but it's also your potential ambassadors. And that is I would say, a non-traditional way of entering a market. Because before that, it's you create a product and then you drop it in and then you throw and see what fits. But now I'm actually saying, spend time in the market, talk to people, build for and around them, and then go back and modify and have your product evolve.
OpenAI has also launched a new brand platform with sonic branding at its heart. How can companies in the sea of new brands in this AI space stand out, and where does sonic branding fit into that? Alicia?
Ooh, I mean, I absolutely loved the brand video that OpenAI released. I think it was so great. Just felt like it had everything. It was super fresh. It had a little bit of ASMR, some nature, some tech. It was just so satisfying to watch. And I think more brands should definitely invest in sound design. When it comes to AI differentiation, I feel really swamped by a lot of, like, personally, very swamped by, you know, website headers that use AI as a buzzword, and it feels overwhelming. So I feel like my personal advice would be to kind of, like, hone in on something very niche when it comes to AI and really focus on one specific problem to solve instead of many, and I don't know, maybe not even a whole industry, like something so specific that you could actually get a particular community or group of people interested in. And I think that would also help branding as well, because if you have a specific audience or a specific niche already, then that just makes things a lot easier. You're not going to be vague and try to please everybody. So I think that's my thoughts.
Now, Michelle, you originally shared this with us. What was the first thing that drew you to it? And sort of made it be like, I need to find out more about this.
So, well, there's so much talk about OpenAI, right? And it's usually not great talk. The video appeared on my LinkedIn, and it was astounding, like, compliments, and everyone was, it's so fresh, like Lisa said, and, you know, it's memorable, it's compelling. So I really wanted to see, like, what is it that they've done well in there? And it's so memorable. It humanizes them to some extent. And the power of sonic branding is, you know, we think that it's so far away, but it's actually it can be so impactful. Like Netflix's Ta-dum. That's just such a good example and one that really sticks with, everyone knows that sound. Like, if I close my eyes, I played it. Or I paid it to anyone with their eyes closed, like anyone would recognize it. And I'm just excited to see that, you know, the creative and marketing world are starting to look at different ways that they could make an impression with the different senses.
And speaking of that Netflix sound, there's a sort of a test of your personality when you hear the HBO intro. What is the song? What is the TV show you hear the intro to immediately afterwards? So that HBO, Sex and the City beginning, True Blood, Succession. So whichever show is the show that piques your interest is the one that is like your an indicator of your personality. Mine is True Blood, so I don't know what that says about me. But
in an area we didn't know this before. This is a revelation. So yeah,
new things every day.
Yeah. It's interesting, you know, all these brands, because we've got the Sonic Branding Accelerator, we also have the New Products Accelerator that has worked with various different brands. And because lots of products have an AI element just now, there's always someone in a leadership team who wants the thing to be called something.ai. And the truth is, if any of you go to any industry conference now, you walk around the floor and you see 50 companies called something.ai that become completely interchangeable. It's like, it's a really bad pattern that goes through the thing. But I think one of the things that's really interesting in the OpenAI brand platform, and actually the use of the sonic branding, is that kind of tactile element. So the fact that every time something comes up, there's that kind of sound response. It makes it really satisfying. It's one of the words I wrote down, and Lisa, you mentioned it as well, which is, I think one of the problems with the experience of AI products a little bit, is that you're always going in to do a thing and then it's kind of half there and then you're doing something else. Actually quite interesting to build your kind of brand experience around something that feels much more satisfying, like you completed a task in some way. So I think that's really positive. So I think, like I say, the visual design the kind of brand world that's developing now is kind of very cohesive. I still think the OpenAI brand has got lots of problems, but you can see why it's happened. And I think actually this, well, last week I was speaking at a business school and everyone's talking about brand building. And I think one of the things that they weren't talking about, and quite often people aren't very honest about, is one of the things that's really hard about branding a new company is that it changes a lot. So in terms of OpenAI, when they founded it and someone was going through the job of what should we call this and what should we make the logo or all these kind of things, would have been saying it's an open source tech company that's going to be driving infrastructure for other people to make. Fast forward a few years, and they're no longer open source. They're actually trying to convince people to use their own tools in the front end through ChatGPT and all these various different things. So I still think it's kind of like when you go through the new brand platform video, the design is lovely. I really love the use of Sonic branding. It's a kind of they grow and up the thing. But when it gets into what they call different products, it's still completely confusing and confused, you know? So there's some stage, if some of these brands are going to become really big brands, then someone does need to sort of dive into that and go, actually, what's the architecture of naming and how are we going to actually build this over time? But I can also understand why that's been really hard. So I think it's like this is a massive step forward for them. Some of the issues that are there are still there in the brand strategy.
Yeah, Nate, that was one of the notes that I wrote down as well. One of the questions, looking at OpenAI's branding was how can a brand actually evolve? Like, is there a right way to do it? Because it's not just the tech that's evolving quickly, but consumers and audiences are as well. We are getting more and more complex. We're more and more plugged in. Some of us want a, a really simple life, but some of us want things that are much more complicated, with different functionalities. So is it even fair to ask that a brand, especially a new brand, evolve as people do? And in the past, there used to be this harkening towards, oh, being the next 100-year-old brand, being the brand that defies time or stands the test of time. And I just wonder if that even something that new brands, especially within the AI space, should even aspire towards. Or are we talking about something else entirely different?
And there's so many of them as well that the brand think that brand has to be something, a tool, a lever to pull to make your one the sticky one. But it's I don't think many of them are doing it very, very well. Which is also an interesting thing given that, their brand teams are the power users of AI itself. You kind of realize where this stuff is so powerful for doing lots of things. But what you really need is some kind of North Star or someone to kind of spot the kind of vision or make the lateral thought around how we're going to build an identity around this to make the whole thing work.
Awesome. Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, I it's always when you look at kind of brand refreshes, this kind of thing, the videos are always fantastic, right? I mean, it's everything, this whole process summed up in 30 seconds. So of course, it's going to be super punchy and wonderful. But yeah, it is interesting to see how that actually translates into the actual product. And are there any noticeable changes? Was it just about a couple spacing changes and color changes? Like, it really de it's hard to say, and I haven't poked around enough to know. But I don't know if, for example, if the Sonic branding is that something that they're carrying into the product.
Yeah, we'll have to see. It'll be interesting to see if they actually do that.
Because I mean, I think to Michelle, your point earlier, it's so interesting. I mean, I feel like at some point, maybe, yeah, brands in the future will every brand will have to have their own sound. That'll just be kind of like commonplace. The Slack like sound for notification is so probably imprinted in everyone's brains for the last 5 years. Like, so yeah, it'll be interesting to see if more and more brands come up with a signature.
So we like to end off these calls with a cultural pick of the week. So your best music, film, TV, design, or book that you found inspiring this week. Let's kick it off with Michelle. What is your cultural pick of the week?
So Matt Klein is a strategist, and I think he's head of foresight at Reddit. And only a couple of days ago, he released this thing that he does every year. It's Nick is nodding his head, but it's the Meta Trending Trends, where he analyzes, I think, more than 50 global trend reports and forecasts. And then he identifies and distills the most reported social shifts. And one really great observation he made was that he realized majority of trend reports are coming from only 10% of the world. So what are we really reporting on when we say global? So you know that was a really good read for me, and it's a cultural pick because it reflects on the culture of my industry. It reflects on the culture of how we consume content and how we think about information that's worth sharing. So yeah, that's my recommendation.
Awesome. Sounds great. Alicia.
Yeah, my recommendation is a book a friend told me about yesterday, and it's a book about Japanese graphic design from 1875 to 1975, so 100 years of Japanese graphic design. And I think it just came out in the past couple of weeks. It's by Ian Lingman. He's a designer, so I'm really excited to run over and buy that. Hopefully, I think next week. But it looks absolutely incredible. I think there's like 500 pages and yeah, 100 years of graphic design from a country. I feel like each country needs this. So
That'd be a hell of a library, actually, if you had each country, no?
yeah,
It
it would. Maybe there should be a library for it then.
Yeah.
So cool.
Nick, anything on your radar? Now you're always.
Oh, okay. I'll just pull out a book as well, but it's a random one we went through. It's called We Peaked It Paper, for anyone interested. Which just like it's like a history thing, but of zine. I really love zine culture right now. So in terms of different things that are coming around. So it's just like the story of the people behind zines, mostly from the UK. But it's called We Peaked on Paper, and it's just a lot of fun. So I think the good thing about zines as well is it's like it's maybe it's sort of related to like a history of Japanese design, but it's more people who care about one thing that nobody else in the world cares about, and they go like once a month we're gonna publish something for the five of us that care about this thing. Gradually it kind of builds into more than five people, but I think that's a kind of glorious thing to do.
What a great title too. Wow. Amazing.
Yeah.
We really did peek at paper. as we sit here fully digital and I haven't seen a piece of paper in a while. Which Josh, you look like you're sort of on the edge of your seat about something.
So I'm just thinking about my HBO show that I would lean after the logo, and it would be The Wire. But that's not my recommendation. My recommendation would probably be, it's actually one that a label mate recommended on a previous podcast that I thought was really interesting and I'd really want to track down. It was Renée de la Cruz who offered forward US creator's book on video art, Barbara London, she's called. And it sounded really fascinating. It's like the curation of how art has sort of transcended with the video format. So like through from like, you know, film cassettes, how artists interact with that and how they actually play with the medium itself rather than just using it as the tool, as a means to an end, interact with how they play with the actual tool itself, which I thought was really, really cool.
And did you figure out what your HBO show was?
Oh, I said The Wire, yeah.
Oh, see, well, that makes sense for you, Josh. It
It makes sense.
doesn't make sense to me.
My
Succession.
Oh, yeah.
Mine's definitely Sex in the City. I can't picture anything else than the intro. You see them all compounding at once.
Nick, we have to know yours now, I think.
Well, I have a weird association with it. I was thinking as you say it because I watched both series of Succession on a flight to Australia one time, which one was a long time, and you get very that music starts to really get in your head. So whenever I hear it, I think I'm on a long flight to Australia. And two, because it was on a flight to Australia, they edited all the sexual references out, which in Succession, some of the plots had real kind of like errors. So it's only when I then somebody else. Hey, you should watch Succession. And then I watched it with them and I was like, oh, that's why that
This
happens.
is why it's a good show. You didn't watch an entirely different show. You were just like, there's some interesting family dynamics going on here. what a complex family. Well, Thank you, everyone, for joining us today. We hope that you're all caught up on the world of innovation this week. If you want to get access to label sessions for your brand or have your teams mentored by our leaders, get in touch via our website or any of the social networks out around there. We're on all of them. See you next week.